I'm Danko Jones. I sing and play guitar in the eponymously named band Danko Jones, and it's good to be here. Thanks, Frederick.
Well, thanks for coming here, Danko. I saw this hilarious information video about your new album, Electric Sounds, where you say that you've noticed that people listen more to your music if you add swear words, and that's why the chorus of your new song, Good Time, goes, I came here to fuck shit up and have a good time.
Sure, those were just done in a big dollop of humor, but I've had fun making them. We've had a kind of an unwritten policy not to like lean on swear words or just sensational little tidbits, even though that's kind of what we do in other departments. But yeah,
you haven't dropped a lot of F-bombs in your songs
exactly
through the years. No,
yeah, so it's definitely being an unwritten rule, but like you get to the 11th album and you're like, let's do shit we haven't done before, which is swear in a rock song, which you know. So it was also like we were criticized for various reasons about like the themes that I used to sing about so much that, you know, it's one thing you can't get us on. You know, like something as base as a swear word.
But which themes did people have a problem with?
Me singing about women and doing in the way that I sang and me being who I am. Looking how I do, I think it was really threatening for a lot of people because I saw other bands doing it and not getting any of the criticism or flack that I did. So that was more a reflection of them than anything else.
You know,
very vague?
You know, no offense, but you know, you don't seem as a very threatening person.
Well, here in your house, which is very lovely, by the way, why should I? I mean, if I really walked around like I do on stage when I'm in front of like a large group of people, I don't think I'd have many friends left because you have to, when you go on stage, even though I'm mic'd up, you know, you still have to like scream and shout and make sure that the back of the room can hear you. And a lot of what we do is getting aggression out. And it's only now that I'm understanding where that aggression comes from. And you know, like that's, people say, is that a persona? Because they see me off stage. I don't think it's a persona. And the people who know me very well, they know it's not a persona. But there is a body chemistry change when you walk out and you see, you know, anywhere between 200 to 20,000 pairs of eyes staring at you. And that's all on me. And that's all my projection of what I've gone through. And that's, and I mean that by like, that's how I interpret it. I interpret it as an aggressive act. And so I get very defensive very quickly. And so you can choose to shut down and walk off stage, or in my head and how I take it, I choose to face it head on, and I get to scream at it, and it comes out in the performance of the songs. And my job on stage is to yell and scream, and it's a perfect job for someone like me, where I can be very cathartic in a short period of time and get it out of my system night after night.
You just said that you recently discovered where the aggression comes from.
So yeah.
Where does it come from?
I mean, that's another five, ten podcasts. But it's, you know, and it's an overused word, but it's, I'm only finding out about trauma and getting to face it. Because I used to think when I played on stage that this was God-given, divine talent that I was able to, you know, I was born with this natural gift to perform. This is all in my head. And this is not a result of anything in my childhood. And I had a revelation a realization during the pandemic that what I was doing on stage was trauma on display. And when I realized that, it's a good thing that I didn't even tell my bandmates. It's a good thing that everything was locked down because I did not want to play live. I was done. There is a short period, short period of time where I was basically, I don't want to get on a stage. I didn't tell them. I don't want them to panic. And I thought maybe this is a phase, and it was. But I was embarrassed that I was putting this on display.
I watched the documentary Bring on the Mountain, where you talk about how you, even though you knew that you had talent, you would still feel, you know, like assume that people hated you when you went on stage.
Exactly. That's
and
exactly
you had kind it. Of like a low self-esteem.
Exactly it. That's all. It's been like that from day one. And I just didn't realize it, that was trauma, like being exercised and lived out over and over again, where I think everyone is against me. And that's really bit me in the ass at times. It's really put my bandmates through, well, especially JC, because him and I formed the band. I'm only realizing now that, like, man, I've put him through unnecessary shit because my mouth has acted faster than my brain. And you're catching me today, this week, this month, at a time where I'm very self-reflexive, and I hesitated doing this, but at the same time, I figured this is good. Let's just do this, because I've lived so close to the vest and been so private, and I still am. I'm super private, but talking about it from this angle, I don't mind.
Does it get better with age?
What gets better? Performance?
Like low self-esteem. To handle it?
Well, I don't know if it's... I have trouble dealing with that term, low self-esteem. But I do believe that every performer who gets out there on stage, especially people who front bands, they're dealing with something, and this is their way of dealing with it. So there is something that they're dealing with. And I just didn't realize that. No matter who it was. And, you know, Damien Abraham from Fucked Up and I have had conversations about that.
He's from Toronto too,
he's from Toronto, yeah. He's a really good friend of mine and we've had conversations about that. And we both agree, you know, like he's a front man and we both agree that there's, you know, there's some heavy shit that's underneath the bravado and the confidence on stage.
One of your first groups was called Three Reasons to Puke.
Yeah.
What were the reasons?
We had none. We were just young and dumb. We were in high school and it sounded cool. And it just sounded like dirty, rotten imbeciles. So, yeah, that's it.
What kind of family did you grow up in?
I was an only child, two immigrant parents, and I come from a mixed background and I have no family other than my mom and dad. I come from a big family, but I've not made any real contact with anyone. So I'm an island. I don't mean to make myself out to be a tragic kind of victim here, but I'm not making it heavier than it is. That's what it is. And so, that's, you know, lived in an apartment till I was 11. And
how did you, perform in school? Were you good in school?
I was a B student because I didn't try, and I just got by. Once I got into music, it really kind of took over, and like school and homework and all that was just like something I had to get through to be able to like listen to music and not have to feel burdened nightly about doing homework. So I really didn't really pay much attention in school. I was consumed and obsessed by music. I still am. So, I mean, it's what I do for a living now. But like once I found music, there was nothing that interested me. I just had to get through it. As long as I maintained like a B average, I was okay.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, well, this song, Deuce by Kiss, is the first song off Kiss Alive, which is the first. I didn't buy it. I got my mom to buy it when I was 6 years old. And so I chose this on the list because this is the seminal album band song that really kind of changed everything for me. This was the one. When I hear Deuce, I'm 6 years old again. And a few things happened getting that Kiss album. Number one, my mom wrote in, she said, if you write a letter into the address on the back, I'll send it in, just to get me to write and be active. And sure enough, I don't know how many months later, I got a package from the Kiss Army, which basically makes you a fan for life. And then number two, my dad broke the record over his knee because I was listening to it too much. And so that also sealed me in as a fan for life because, you know, if you're going to tell me that I can't do it, then I'm going to do it.
But why did your father object to Kiss?
Because it was vulgar and obscene and, you know, it's not upstanding and all the classic reasons why parents don't like their kids getting into rock and roll. And what they don't understand is the more you take it away from someone, the more that they want it. And so breaking it over his knee was such a memory in my head that I could not have, you know, you're never going to not make me want this.
Could you get a new copy?
Never did, but what I did is I segued into cassettes because I figured in my 7-6-year-old brain, he can't break a cassette over his knee. Like, there's no way you can do that. Even if you try, you can't really do it. You'd have to, like, take a hammer. The hammer part never occurred to me, but I figured it's smaller and I can listen to it in my room, whereas the stereo was in the living room, so everybody heard it. Whereas in my room, I can be the only one to listen to it. And so I just bought cassettes till I was, you know, I guess in my late teens. I just kept buying cassettes because, and even into my 20s because of the Walkman.
In case your father would show up with a hammer.
Yeah, or the Walkman. So I have such a hate on for cassettes that people don't understand where it comes from, but that's because I lived with a Walkman for all the way up till I was in my 20s. And how many times did the batteries wear out and I had to go home with no music? And it's kind of like, you know, someone who can't get a drink, like an alcoholic who can't get a drink. Like, I couldn't stand going anywhere without music playing in my ears. So that's why I hate cassettes.
I know that you once showed up at a record store where your favorite band, Death Angel, had an autograph session, and you showed up in your school uniform.
Yeah.
How did they react to that?
Catholic boys' school. They made fun of me. Mark and Andy made fun of me. And it was cool. They signed my album, but I was just like, damn it. Why? Like, I didn't have time to go from school, go home, because it was like an hour and 15 minutes to get home from school, and then go back downtown to the Record Peddler on Carlton, if there are any people from Toronto listening. That's when the Peddler was on Toronto, and make it in time for the autograph session. So what I did was I went downtown, bought a second copy of the second album, Frolic Through the Park, and then I showed up to the, and then I waited in line. And yeah, and then I told them that years and years later. And it was so nice. Mark was, Death Angel were playing in Toronto. This is going back about 10 years ago. And he told the story on stage and he apologized to me, which I thought was very sweet. And I in turn told the story on stage last year at Wacken. It's like a full circle and then another full circle.
Did your parents encourage you to pursue a career in music?
Quite the opposite. They didn't want me to do it at all. There was like, you know, I come from both sides. There's academics and that's what you're supposed to do. A career in the arts, let alone a career in rock and roll, is just not something that's respectable. And it's also, a lot of it is about keeping up appearances. But they bore a son that was obsessed with music and the arts, and that's, you know, I picked the shortest straw and I had to, you know, live with their disappointment. And even to this day, you know, it's not the same. So
sometimes
your answer is, the answer to your question is no.
Sometimes when you like have immigrant parents, they will, I have some friends who have like parents from Iran, and they always want their kids to be either lawyers or dentists. And, you know, no other professions really exist.
Exactly.
And yet you have this pressure to succeed.
You have a pressure to succeed that's unlike any pressure any boss or any teacher will put on you, especially if you're the only child. And I don't know how I mustered up the strength to buck that, but I bucked it. And I just said, I'm going to pay the consequences. And the consequences were emotional detachment and disappointment, or both, or whatever, or one, or if it's the same thing, I don't know.
So they don't come to see you live if you play in Toronto?
They have, you know, when I've like, well, they're very old now, but when we've been around for 27 years.
How old are you, by the way?
I'm very not young.
It's impossible to Google.
Oh, really?
Someone said 1982.
I love it.
And I felt, well, then it was 18 when I saw him live the first time. That's a little bit too young, but
I'll keep you guessing. How about that? And then we'll do a giveaway at the end of the podcast if anyone gets it right. But I know it's not this kind of podcast. But what was your question?
Whether your parents went to see you live.
They did, when I thought this was a big enough milestone to check out. So when we played Maple Leaf Gardens in 2000, we opened up for Beck. And I figured, okay, Maple Leaf Gardens, that's, you know, that's a pretty big, and they know what Maple Leaf Gardens is. It's kind of like the Canadian Madison Square Gardens. It's where the Toronto Maple Leafs played. It's where Borja Salming played. And, you know, my dad and I have seen games there. So he knew what that was. No response. Then we played at the Air Canada Centre, which is kind of the updated version of Maple Leaf Gardens. No response. So, like, after that, I just basically, no, nothing.
So they didn't come to the show?
They did. They came
to
those two
shows.
Not really.
Okay.
There's been times, like, we played, I can't believe I'm talking about this, because I don't really like talking about this, but I will. I'll say this much. We played Moscow Stadium, opening up for Guns N' Roses. And I called my father. That's it. I didn't get a response.
No. Did you see the Woody Allen documentary where he meets his parents?
No.
He brings his very young girlfriend to meet his parents.
I'm glad you said that.
And his mother
It's very problematic, Woody Allen.
Well, I know they've been married a long time, though. It's problematic. But anyway, he brings her to see his parents, and Woody Allen's mother starts complaining about why couldn't you meet a nice Jewish girl? And why this movie thing? You should be a doctor. She's still, you know, unhappy that he chose to be a director, no matter how many Oscars he has won.
That's amazing.
You know, because he should have been a doctor. He could have been a lawyer. He could have had a real job. They're still unhappy.
Well,
and he's like well into his 70s in that documentary.
Yeah.
And his parents like 100 years old.
I was going to say, like, how's that conversation even happen in 2023?
You've toured a lot with the Backyard Babies.
We did two tours. Yeah, we've done two tours with them.
You're friends with them. I know that because you sang on one of my favorite Backyard Babies tracks called Friends.
Yes.
Where they invited Joey Ramone, Nina Persson from the Cardigans, and Mike Monroe. And you all sing about friends. And your verse goes like this. I've got a friend. Her name is Grace. When we broke up, it put a smile on my face.
Sure.
Who was Grace? And you stayed friends after you broke up, apparently.
Grace was a made-up name that rhymed with face.
Face, okay.
But in truth, they are my friends, and Dragan is a hell of a guy. And, you know, they took us out when nobody would touch us. And Dragan took us out because he genuinely wanted a band to, like, rock out on the tour. And we got along, and it was probably the most memorable tour I've ever been on. And I'll never forget him for that.
A lot of rock stars are failed music journalists, but you've done really well in both professions. You know, you've written for the Huffington Post.
Oh, anyone can write magazine. For the Huffington Post. That's not a big get. You just submit, you send an email with your essay.
Yeah, but you had a really good blog there.
Thank you. I compiled all those into a book that came out on Feral House. And I saw on your bookshelf outside there a few Feral House books. And so you know the weight that imprint carries, or at least it does with me. So being on Feral House for my first book was like being on Touch and Go or being on Amphetamine Reptile. Like it was like such a cool thing to be our Merge or you know, Matador or something. So it was such a cool thing to be a part of. So this song, Freaky Styly by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, is the title track by the George Clinton produced album from I think 85. And this is when the Peppers were a different band than I think everybody knows today. They were just spontaneous, unpredictable, wild. Every single word you can come up with to describe, like, any word you can use to catch my attention. And that's basically in this song. The line is, I fuck them just to see the look on their face. I fuck them just to see the look on their face. And that is my mantra. It is my, I live by that.
You once wrote in the Huffington Post about how bored you were with, like, rock and roll cliches, what musicians say when they're interviewed. And you put it like this. Listening or reading about what a musician has to say about their music is the holy grail of torture. It's the equivalent to getting your leg sawed off without any anesthesia or forcing you to swallow your own eyeballs after they've been poked out. I have almost poked my own eyeballs out when I've heard the nonsense that comes out of the mouths of these yokels who play five chords on a guitar. Did you do a lot of interviews as well?
Yes. What can I say about that? I'm a tad embarrassed by that, only because I find it funny still, but also I don't know what to say. It's true, but it's not true. You know, it's obviously it's an exaggeration of something that I feel like. My point being, like, I think a lot of musicians and bands tend to take themselves a little too seriously because all the attention is focused on them and they're the ones being asked questions all the time and they're always talking about themselves. And that over a period of time, and I can't say that I'm not guilty of it, but you get this like really fucked up perception of the world. And so that was just basically my point, is like, I think a lot of musicians take themselves too seriously and think they're all that when they're not. And all they're doing is just playing songs.
So was there any special interview that you had been watching?
No.
Which made you want to poke your eyes out?
Oh, at the time?
Yeah.
I'm sure that provoked that article, but I can't remember it. I honestly can't, but I'm pretty sure for me to write that, I was provoked by something that I saw or read, you know, and it's one of those things where you just start to kind of say it out loud in the room going, Jesus Christ, you're like, you know, you think you're all that or whatever.
It seems as if you have like a slight allergy to pretentiousness, because I know that you also didn't like people calling you an artist. You found that the word artist was a slur.
I do. I find it. I can't even say it myself. Like,
I've never thought about it that way because it's so common that you know
it
you
is. Just. And that's another thing is everyone's an artist. It's like everyone's an artist, and
so according to you, an artist is someone who like paints and
art. Someone who's in the fine arts, and music is included in that.
Okay,
but I just,
so when you reach that level, do you need to be, you know, very technically skilled to become an artist, or
it's very intangible, and it's really hard for me to describe what I would say in the world of music, who would be an artist and who wouldn't be classified as an artist. But one thing I know is I can't sit here and think that I'm an artiste. Like that just,
well,
it
if
just
you pronounce
make,
it like that, it sounds so snobby, but artiste.
It's artist. Very, I feel uncomfortable saying it, you know, like I just do. And then I say that, and then in the very next sentence I'll say like, everybody thinks rock and roll is lowbrow. So I don't know what I'm very confused in that sense. Well, I bought this album because of the cover. When I was about 15 or 16, I found it at Vortex Records at Yonge and Eglinton in Toronto, and it blew my mind.
This is Black Flag's first or second album?
No, I think it. No, it's like a few albums into the Rollins era, and Chuck Dukowski wrote the lyrics for My War. Just found that out very recently. I thought it was Henry. And it's just the angriest set of lyrics put to the angriest, rawest music I've ever heard in my life. And it became my theme. It became my shield. It became everything to me. And I lived by that song, you know, You're One of Them. You know, like My War, You're One of Them. You said you're my friend, but you're one of them, one of them. That was another mantra that I carried with me. And you know, yeah. And so that's why I put it on that list. This is My War by Black Flag.
Every day drives me insane. I feel in my heart. If I had a gun, I'd feel in my heart. If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I spoke to Thomas Seltzer, the bass player from Turbo Negro.
Yeah.
And
Happy Tom.
And you toured a little bit with him, and I asked him if, you know, what their first impressions were of you.
Of me?
Yes. And he said that you felt exotic.
He felt exotic?
He felt that you were exotic. All the members of Turbo Negro felt that you were very exotic. Can you guess why?
Because I'm a brown guy? I'm a person of color? I don't know why.
No, because you did not drink. And they were like severe Norwegian alcoholics, all of them. So for someone not to drink was like a wow. That's interesting.
But that's not anything that's strange and new in the world of punk rock, which is where Turbo Negro live and are from, the world of punk rock. I mean, when I handed in the list for this podcast, I erased one of the first songs I put down was Out of Step by Minor Threat, because that was, and Minor Threat were a band that, you know, I think there's a section of us who like worship Ian, you know, in that sense. Like the whole, what would Ian do is something me and Damian Abraham have talked about. I didn't think it was too out of line because, you know, we are a garage punk band. I have a background in punk rock, and I didn't think it was too crazy to like come out and just go, I don't drink. I don't consider myself straight edge. You know, I've broken edge a few times in my life, and I'm not straight edge anymore at all, by any means at all. And I don't use it to define me, and it's not, you know, it's not who I am. But there's been times in my life where, you know, that song came in handy.
Maybe Turbo Negro were so drunk at that point that they didn't even like see the connection between you and like...
Minor threat. maybe. But I think I've even put that in... I think I'm out of step like Minor Threat, baby. I think I put that in one of our songs. That's a line out of our song? I'm pretty sure it was.
I first heard about you when you played at the Hultsfred Festival in Sweden, like in the early 2000s?
2001 and 02 we played, I believe.
And was that like your first visit to Europe, or was...
01 was our first... We played the Hultsfred festival on our first tour of Europe, yes. And it was under a tent. And Jello Biafra and Nashville Pussy came to see us after we played. And so I was like, wow.
So Jello Biafra was in Hultsfred?
In 01 he did, yeah. Oh. Yeah, he was doing some sort of spoken thing. And Blaine and Ryder from Nashville Pussy brought him to see us play. And since then, he's come to see us a few times. In fact, the last time we played San Francisco, I think I got an email from someone from Alternative Tentacles saying, like, through Jello, saying, like, I didn't know you guys were playing in town or I would have come. So,
how much of a, like, punk rocker were you in your teens? Did you, like, change the way you look a lot? Or?
No, I was a heavy metal kid who started getting into punk rock through metal magazines that wrote about it. And when I got into the Bad Brains and I realized, like, what am I listening to right now? What am I looking at and what am I listening to? And then it was produced by the guy from the Cars. What is going on here? That fucked with all the compartmentalization I had in my head about what music was and what music wasn't and what was cool and what wasn't. And I realized, no, you just like what you like and let the chips fall where they may. And after that, I got into everything. And when I left high school, I just got into anything that sounded good to me. And things that didn't sound good, I'm gonna keep listening to it until I get it. And rap music, I got into rap music when I was in high school, but that was because the Bad Brains let me get into it because they would play Coptic Times and then go into Rally Round Ya Throne in the next track. That really didn't make sense to me. But yet it was so, the music was so amazing that I had to pay attention to what they were doing. And then the whole Rick Ocasek thing didn't understand. Like, the guy from the Cars was producing like the wildest band I'd ever heard in my life. And they weren't white. And that also was such, like, made such an impression on me. And it helped me just go, you can do this too, you know? And after that, my musical listening expanded and everything. That was just very seminal in my head.
This is the Bad Brains track that you picked, Rock for Light.
Rock for Light, because it's the title track to the album that fucked with me the most.
Besides working as a music journalist, you also worked once in a porn shop. What was that like?
Yeah, I did. And I was listening to your podcast, and Corey Taylor worked in a porn shop too.
Sure he did. Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. I worked in a porn shop for 10 months in 1999, and it was terrible. I hated it. It was on Yonge Street, which is like it's the heart of downtown, and the most terrible people are going through there. And yeah, everything that you would imagine happening in a porn shop on Yonge Street in Toronto, near Yonge and College, happened. Everything you would imagine that happened, happened.
Did you get attacked or anything?
I got keys thrown at me, yeah, right in front of
keys.
About as close as where I'm sitting to you. So if you're me, the person just whipped, and it was like, it's too long a story, but there was undercover cops waiting to bust the place because my boss entered into a partnership with another guy who had strippers in the back room. And I found out later that crazy stuff was going on in there and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I just needed the job. I needed the money. And I was doing double shifts because down the street at Yonge and Dundas, I was working at a record store. So I would finish my shift at like 5 o'clock, 5:30, and then I would start my 6 to 10 shift at the record store. So I would work 12 hours. There was days where I'd work 12 hours.
Why would anyone throw their keys at someone?
It was one of the strippers, and she didn't like the fact that when I went on break, I had to close the store because the strippers were in the back room. So when I go out for a break, they can't get business. And there was this whole thing, like, I was like, well, how am I supposed to get food, or how am I supposed to take a break? Like, how am I supposed to do this, this, or this? Like, I can't, so I have to stay in the store. And she's like, well, when you leave, you know, that's how it was. And then she just took her keys and whipped it at my face. It was crazy. And I don't want to say anything, but there was, you know, it was, yeah, there's stuff going on there. And I was completely innocent in terms of, I just wanted to be a store clerk. And that was it. And I just wanted to sell the goods that people wanted to buy. And that was it. And it turned into this huge, giant mess between me and the strippers and me wanting to take a break. And I can't leave the store unattended.
Did you get to pick the music that they stripped to?
No. It was in the back room. Like, okay, it was, so there was like booths, and then there was a back room, and it was, I didn't want to even go near there. And the element there was so toxic and so negative. And eventually I was like, what am I doing? Like, I can get another job, you know? And it was great because it was flexible, and we were touring around regionally, and it was just crazy. It was just crazy. She got really mad because I wanted to close the store when I took a break, because I couldn't leave the store unattended, that she whipped keys at me.
So the record store was easier to work at.
Oh God, record store was, it was like, I hated the store because it was like this chain, but you didn't, you know, like it, like leaving the porn shop and then going to work at the record store was like exhaling. I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? It's like filled with the worst people in the world, and there's so many bad elements, and there's undercover cops, and I'm going to get in trouble for nothing, just sitting behind a counter, like wanting to just do my job. So that's what happened.
Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you. Oh man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
This is one of the songs why I feel so close to, like, I love Neil Young. And this song, I don't know who it's about. I have to assume it's about his dad.
Old man.
Yeah, and it could be about any old man, I suppose. But for me, as a listener, I think of my dad and how alike we are and how different we are. And, you know, yeah, it's a tough song. It's a tough song to listen to these days, but it's always been like, it's always been in the back of my mind, and one of the reasons why I love Neil Young so much. Beautiful. And it's one of these songs that perfectly captures a son and his father who are, and you can tell just by that line that they don't get along, that there's a lot of anger and a lot of disagreement and a lot of silence between them and a lot of space between them, a lot of distance between them, just by that line. And just by that line, I can like, it's like 1,000 lines.
Isn't there this YouTube video of Neil Young walking into a record store and being really upset because they're selling bootlegs?
Well, I think that's when I get off the Neil Young train, and I think you're just the old man saying, get off my lawn at that point. I mean, you're Neil Young. I mean, you know, I get it. They're cutting into your share, but you're Neil Young. I mean, yeah.
in Close Up magazine, the Swedish metal magazine that you used to write for, you wrote quite a lot about your lifelong obsession with Kiss.
Sure. To the point where Robon, my editor, told me to stop. He did. I wish I had that email. And he was like, you have to stop writing about Kiss. And I said, fair enough, fair enough.
I couldn't but help notice that you put Inge Johansson, a Swedish musician, in your latest video.
Yeah.
He used to be a member in the International Noise Conspiracy. And he's, you know, if that's possible, even more of a Kiss nut than you are.
He is, actually. It's crazy. I didn't know, but he is. Inge, I've known him since, first of all, the very first show he played in on European soil was in Stockholm at the University of Stockholm. Nobody knew who we were except the three guys from the International Noise Conspiracy who showed up to the gig, Inge, Dennis, and Ludwig, because we had toured with them in the States in a few months previous. So they just came by to say hello. And that was our very first show in Europe in 2001. So that's how long we've known those guys for. And it makes sense that Inge's in our video. And I just was DMing him yesterday. And his new band, Gataplan, I love Gataplan. It's crazy. He's a bigger Kiss fan than I am, that's for sure.
I think he went to the office in New York where they once had their first rehearsal space.
Right.
To check out the building.
Sure. I wouldn't be surprised if there's guided tours for Kiss Army fans.
I think there aren't. And the people working in that office are, you know, sort of fed up with Kiss fans
right.
coming there.
Right. I can imagine.
Kiss isn't really one of my favorite bands, but I really love to read about them, especially about their less successful periods, like when they tried to be more highbrow when they did The Elder or when they removed the makeup. It's such a strange mixture of like extreme commercialism and just pure insanity.
Yeah, I love it. I have a battle vest, is what you call it, those jean jackets where there's like patches, and every patch on the jean jacket is a Kiss unmasked era. So the 13 years that they didn't wear makeup, I have all the patches. And my whole point was if you didn't know who Kiss was and you flew and you landed on planet Earth and you saw my battle vest, you would swear that Kiss were this band, just a rock and roll band who never wore makeup. And every patch on my battle vest is makeup free.
Must have taken a long time to collect all those patches.
It did. It took a few years. It took a few years. I'd get inspired and then I'd stop and then I'd get inspired and then eventually it got sewed on.
Sweden was one of the countries where they were still massive when they removed the makeup, like around the time of Asylum and Crazy Nights.
They were still big in America. Heavens on Fire was a number top 10 hit, at least. Okay. Yeah. Heavens on Fire was a top 10 hit. Tears Are Falling was a kind of top 30 hit. They had a couple of like top 30, top 10 hits. Lick It Up did well, the title track. So no slouching.
I know that as a kid, you dreamed about how the members of Kiss were your older brothers.
Yes.
Because you were an only child.
Yes. And they wore makeup, so you couldn't tell the real color of their skin. And because they all had black hair, you know, it could have gone either way.
Also, you have a very long tongue. I've seen pictures of it. And, you know, if you have a tongue that's as long as yours, I imagine that it's not that difficult to think that Gene Simmons is your older brother.
Right. And in fact, there is a photo that JC took of me and Gene in 2005 in Philadelphia. We were playing this radio event and he was hosting it. And so we took a photo. He's really nice to us. And I said, can we do a photo with our tongue sticking out? And he said, no. And so I go, can I stick mine out? And he goes, sure. And the photo is me sticking out my tongue and Gene looking at it. And I thought that was really sweet of him to do. I don't know if he did it on purpose or if JC was quick on his feet and snapped it when he could, but that photo exists.
How much do you follow them now? Have you been to see their final tour?
I have not. I've only seen Kiss once.
Really?
Yeah.
And when was that?
Psycho Circus. So I was working at the record store down the street from the porno shop, and Kiss were playing that night, and I was working the shift till 10 or maybe till earlier. I can't remember. I was working cash, and these kids come in, and they're from out of town, and they're talking about, yeah, we're going to the show. And then one of them goes, what are we going to do with this extra ticket? And I just said, I'll buy it. I didn't know who they were. I'll buy it off you guys. So they said, okay, come to our hotel room at such and such time. And I guess I was working a shift that ended at 6. I went to their hotel room. I didn't know who these people were. I bought the ticket off them. And I watched Kiss by myself next to these strangers. And when I came late and I missed the first song, which was Psycho Circus. The second song when I got to my seat was Deuce, which is the song that we played earlier. And when that happened, I started crying like a baby. So that, and I just said, you know, I've never been to a Kiss show because I didn't have anyone to go with. And
really?
Yeah. And then when I was older, I wasn't really into, I was into other things. You know, I was into noise rock or, you know, whatever, Slint. I didn't pay attention to Kiss. And then, yeah, I found my way back. And so ever since then, I've hesitated to go because I just don't want it to taint watching the four original do Deuce. That was it. I just don't want to. And it's not because I don't think they're great and I don't think, and I think Eric and Tommy aren't good. No, it's just, I just don't want anything tainting that. Like the absolute connection I felt when they hit Deuce was like, holy fuck. I'm getting emotional now because it was amazing.
And how come you hadn't seen them before that? They didn't pass through Toronto when you were like in your late teens or anything. Or maybe you weren't that into them.
I wasn't into them during all those years. You know, I paid attention, but not enough to part with my hard-earned money. I'd rather go see like Nuclear Assault than go see Kiss. You know what I mean? Like I was a heavy metal thrash kid who was starting to get into punk rock, and Kiss were like something I was into when I was in grade 7. And that's how I viewed it until I came around again.
How big is your Kiss collection?
I got rid of a lot of stuff.
You did?
Yeah.
Did you have the pinball machine?
No. No, not that big. Although, you know, Frank from Hatebreed, he's like huge Kiss collector. Like huge. He actually sent me some Kiss stuff. So yeah, like that guy's got, I don't know if he's got the pinball machine, but he's got a sizable collection.
That's often the last piece of collectible that you buy before you go insane.
Yes. And what I did was when I joined the Kiss Army when I was 6 and they sent me, so what did they send me? They sent me these 8x10 glossies of the solo photos and school notebooks because they could tell that the person who wrote it was a child. And I recently, like maybe 6-7 years ago, found those glossy photos on eBay. So I bought them thinking that, oh my God, I found the Holy Grail. This is what I got when I was 6 years old. And I got sent color photo copies of the originals, but I got ripped off on eBay, but I still have them, which is what I didn't have before. So now I have a colored photocopy of what I used to have when I was 6 years old.
And how many times have you met them? Or have you met all of them?
No.
Just Gene. Right?
Just Gene. I could have met Peter at this convention, but circumstances didn't allow me. And I met Eric, but I don't know if that counts. And that's about it in terms of like members. Yeah.
But you had Peter Criss's ex-wife on your podcast.
Lydia Criss. I met Lydia. She was so nice on an off day when we were on tour in America in 2013. And I bought her book off her that day. And yeah, so she made a sale that day. But she was really nice, so nice. And we kept in contact after that as well. Why did I do this, man? Because I put every song on here is getting me emotional.
Well, you've cried four times already on this podcast. I have to say that I'm impressed how connected you are to your emotions.
Well, the music, it just means a lot to me.
Yeah.
But this one's really... This is like falling in love. And this is the song that made me... Like, this is a song that I listened to when I was falling in love. And we were on tour. And back then, long time ago, I had a Discman. If you guys remember what that is.
You put CDs in, right?
But you put CDs
in. So you moved from the Walkman to the Discman.
From the Walkman to the Discman. And I didn't have a CD player at home. So when I would be at home... I would hook up this Discman to speakers, and I would listen to CDs that way. And then when I went on tour, I just unplugged it and put batteries in it, and away I went on tour. But the problem is you have to also bring a CD booklet that was really, really heavy. And so I brought with me the double disc that I had of Curtis Mayfield's Greatest Hits. And one of the songs on the Greatest Hits is Move On Up, and that became the soundtrack to me falling in love. And I can't listen to that song without hearing it, without feeling it, I mean. It's really, you're doing this on purpose.
Take nothing less than the supreme best. Do not obey, you must be forsaken, but you can pass the test.
All right. That's it. Please. I'm getting emotional, but it's also like the music means so much to me. And we're walking down memory lane, and you know, the whole thing about the music industry is to move forward. And, you know, like looking back is something that, you know, part of the music industry never does. And looking back on these songs, you know, it's really weighty.
There's a picture of Lemmy behind me on the wall here.
I saw it.
I believe that you toured a little bit with Motorhead, and you also got to sing Killed by Death with him on stage at least 20 times.
Bunch of times.
Yeah. What was that like? And how much time did you spend with Lemmy?
They took us on tour for a couple of months in 08. And before that and after that, we would play shows with them. And Lemmy would bring me up, or Phil and Lemmy and Mickey would bring me up. And I got to sing Killed by Death. And for me, as like an awkward teenager and looking at Motorhead's black and white image, it's such a strong image. It was like complete validation. And Lemmy was so kind to our band. And what do you say? Like, I don't know what else to say that hasn't been said, and that is being said as we speak somewhere in the world, praising and admiring him. He's such a one of a kind of guy, and yeah, so nice to us, and yeah, it was amazing. It was awesome. Yeah. And yeah, I got to sing Killed by Death. And Killed by Death is actually one of my favorite two songs of the two top two favorite songs of Motorhead. If I got to sing Shine with them, then I would have been like a pig in shit. I would have been so happy. But yeah, Killed by Death, I mean, it was amazing.
Lemmy was also in the short movie that you made called The Ballad of Danko Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is an adventure movie where your band is trying to save the world from this evil scientist played by Ralph Macchio, I think.
The Karate Kid, yeah.
And he's trying to clone musicians?
Clone people or something. I kind of didn't get the story. We just kind of like went along with whatever. The directors were Jason and Josh Diamond, who are friends of ours. And they got Elijah Wood, who's a friend of theirs. And once Elijah Wood was on board, it was easy to get everyone else. And even though we knew Lemmy and we were friends and everything, you know, you dangle you dangle Elijah Wood and Selma Blair and in the mix, you put that in the mix, and like we stand a better chance of getting Lemmy to come down here. Even though we were shooting in LA, he lived in LA, and all he wanted was Jack and Coke in a limo and being driven in a limo to and from the set, which was an easy ask.
That insane plan to clone artists kind of sounds plausible now when you've got record companies trying to, you know, come up with plans for how to create AI versions of artists.
Yeah.
And just, you know, keep putting out music by any musician, dead or alive,
yeah,
whether they like it or not. You know, it's actually something that might happen right now.
I guess that was ahead of its time, but yeah. For us, it was just a fun thing to get like really big names in our videos. And we did the first one with Elijah Wood and Selma Blair and Lemmy and Mike Watt, who introed the whole thing. And while we were shooting, I just said, how do we top ourselves? Like, we can't top this unless we get like the Karate Kid. And that was just because, not to make fun of Ralph, but it was just like the farthest thing from our heads. Like, it's like saying Luke Skywalker to me. And then when we had a production meeting for the second video, it was like, you want to try and get them? It's like, holy shit, you think we can? And there was no Cobra Kai Netflix series. Nothing was happening. And he said yes. And he said yes when he came on set. He said yes because his son told him to do it because we had a song on EA Sports' hockey that year. And his son was playing the video game and knew our band. And that's how he was like, okay, I'll do it.
The most famous band that you've opened for is probably the Rolling Stones.
Sure.
What was that like?
Surreal. The Stones, you know, they do business in Canada, and there's people behind the scenes. And so, yeah, like there's a lot of things that it was like everything clicked for us to get that gig. And there's, I don't know if I've said it on the record, but yeah, anyways, we got the gig and it was amazing. And funny thing is, I've been emotional here. I cried during their sound check. So yeah, you got me, I don't know why I'm doing this, but yeah, like, that's the theme of this episode, I suppose, but it was amazing. Yeah, they're doing hot stuff, and I just was like, holy shit. And I was standing right in front of them. And they told everyone that no one could be in front. They had everyone sound check. While the Stones are sound checking, you got to go at the back of the room if you're going to be in the room. But I was sitting on our cabinets in front of the stage, and no one told me to move. And I just watched it. And then I look back and everyone's behind me. I didn't even know. And that was amazing. And I heard later on, like, stories about people who worked their rehearsals in Toronto that week. And one was like Ron Wood put on her album, Born a Lion. And then I heard from a Belgian journalist when Keith Richards was asked what his favorite bands were, he said the White Stripes and Us. And so, yeah, there's some really cool things that came out from it.
I remember when the Hives opened for the Rolling Stones in Copenhagen, mm-hmm. and Howlin' Pella, at the end of their set, he says, thank you very much. Now, don't go anywhere because there's a great British group coming on after us.
I love it. The balls on that line. I love it. We had a band open for us, Admirals for Cloudsley Shovel, who I love, from London. And they used to say, stick around for Danko Jones. And I loved it. We used to laugh about that.
4 years ago, you covered the song You Love It by fellow Toronto artist Peaches.
Mm-hmm.
I was a bit surprised that you covered her, but do you know her or do you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, actually we want like.
Very nice or fantastic electronic artist.
Before she moved to Berlin in Toronto, like we tried to get her to open for some of our shows. And then I talked to her over the phone and she said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm moving to Berlin. And then I said to myself, why the fuck would you do that? And then, of course, everything blew up for stemming from her move to Berlin. And that was a really interesting time. I didn't spend any time with her, but she was hanging around my house that I was living in at the time because I was roommates with Brendan Canning from Broken Social Scene. So him and I used to live together. And at the time, he was going out with Leslie Feist, and Feist's roommate was Peaches. So there was the four of us kind of in the same circle of friends. And now, 20 plus years later, you look back on that kind of circle and it's kind of like, whoa, Peaches, Feist, Brendan, and myself, we were all, you know, kind of in the same circle.
She did this amazing duet with Iggy Pop.
Oh, yeah. You Love It.
Yeah.
Is it called You Love It? No, it's called Pump It, Hit It. Hit it. Yeah. Like you said, search and destroy.
Yeah,
I know. Which I thought was the best line to say back to Iggy Pop.
I saw her once at the Hultsfred Festival, and then she had like a huge screen with a projection of Iggy.
Amazing.
And they did a duet on stage.
Amazing. She's amazing.
I send my love to you. I send my hands to you. I send my clothes to you. I send my nose to you. I send my trees to you. I send my pleas to you. Won't you send some back to me? Send your ways to me. Send your call to me.
This is Palace or Palace Brothers and their song, I Send My Love to You. And I've just realized over the years, I've sung a lot about love, and love isn't enough.
What do you need more?
You need empathy.
The moon is falling, my wounds are calling, my head is bleeding, and I'm a duck.
I love this vocal production. It's very, you know, brittle. Is that the word?
Stark?
Stark. Thanks.
Raw, yeah.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
And how much have you listened to Will Oldham?
Is it just this song
that gets you? Or?
Yeah, there's another song on off this album called You Will Miss Me When I Burn, which is kind of the opposite vibe. But beyond the first Palace Brothers album, which was like the purple cover, and this album, that's pretty much what I've hung my hat on. But this song gets me every time.
Send it all to me. And when I'm high in the square, when I would have you there, you will be.
Well, Frederick, it's been nice. I have to catch a plane to Paris, and I really mean it. It sounds very cosmopolitan and international traveler type, but I really do have to get to Paris.
It's been a pleasure having you here. I'm sorry if I made you cry.
No,
did that to yourself.
I made myself cry, you Frederick. Did, yeah. You know, the music is what it is, and I just, you know, wish everyone can connect to music.
Thank you, Danko.
Thank you, Frederick. Texanica.
I spent too much time wasting it all away, but now I know.
podcasten produceras av Daniel Bäckström för Leon Media, Danko Jones, Vamos Dragon.